History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. One of the best known and most infamous events in American history is the Lincoln assassination. The details are pretty well known. Lincoln goes to Ford's Theater. John Wilkes Booth, the actor, assassinates him. He shouts, "Sic semper tyrannis," he's arrested, and that's it. There are other details that have entered into the lore, such as Lincoln having a vision that he was going to be assassinated, or that John Wilkes Booth was connected to officials and officers in the Confederacy, so it was likely a Confederate assassination conspiracy. But a lot of those assumptions that have glommed onto the historical event aren't exactly true. Today I'm speaking with Robert Hutchinson, who's author of the book The Lincoln Assassination, What Really Happened, and he takes a look at the case and explores all the events that led up to April 14th, 1865. Among the things we discuss in this episode are, did the Confederacy have a hand in the assassination plot? Who were the accomplices of John Wilkes Booth? And why did he change the plan from kidnapping to assassination? And why was it so easy for Booth to enter the president's box at Ford's Theater? John Wilkes Booth was a very famous actor in his day, and he was able to get access to Ford's Theater, and he knew all the layout of it because he had performed there many times. So we come around to the thought that John Wilkes Booth is sort of the Derek Zoolander of American history. He is also a person who's ridiculously good-looking, able to access places because he's a celebrity, and some would wonder, was he brainwashed into assassinating Lincoln? So a lot of similarities with Derek Zoolander, but also a good reexamination of a historical fact that most people think they know a lot about, but there are always new details to uncover. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Robert Hutchinson. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Well, I love learning things that I didn't know about someone who is very well researched, and Abraham Lincoln probably fits in that category better than anyone else. And the Lincoln assassination is interesting because I think a lot of people would think that they're familiar with the basic story. Ford's Theater, John Wilkes Booth enters, shouts, "Sic semper tyrannis," and then he runs off and he's captured. But what initially keyed you in to the idea that there was something else to the story of the Lincoln assassination?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote this particular book, we were going to launch the What Really Happened series, which is trying to sort through key events in history that have a lot of different versions of what happened, and people don't know exactly actually what happened. And so the goal of this series is to retell in a simple way or in a clear way, in sort of a journalistic way, what, as far as the best as we can determine, what really happened without conjectures and theories and things like that. And what really kind of drove me and the editors as well to the Lincoln assassination is how similar to our own time the atmosphere around it actually was. It was a time of obviously bitter polarization in American politics. And the same parties were operative back then that are operative today. It was the Republicans and the Democrats. And, you know, the rancor and the vitriol that was directed towards Lincoln is somewhat similar to some of the rancor and vitriol that's directed to the current presidents in the last couple administrations. So that was what really kind of first drew me to the story. And then when I learned more about it and really dug in deeply, I realized the whole backstory to the whole assassination that most people don't know about, the whole plan to kidnap Lincoln and the whole sort of attempt to help save the South through this dramatic act. I don't think people quite realize that what Booth was trying to do was to give the South a fighting chance by basically bringing down the U.S. government in a dramatic way, either through kidnapping Lincoln or then in the end through assassinating him. That's basically what drove me to it.
Something else with the world of America right in the Civil War during this period with an intense polarization. I think in the opening of your book, you mentioned that with the blockade of the Confederacy in the Gulf of Mexico, there are Union shipmen who sometimes come ashore, something I had absolutely no idea about, and they're interacting with Confederates. What are other little touch points like this that you think color this world right before the assassination?
Well, yeah, that really amazed me. You know, I guess in my sort of ignorance, I kind of imagined that this, we were at war, so I imagined that the lines were fairly hard. And I never quite realized how porous the border was with the Confederacy and how people moved back and forth relatively easily, civilians especially. I mean, there's a great story that I talk about in my book of one of the actresses who was at Ford Theater, was actually from the South, and she had gone north to Washington to beg for the life of her little brother who had been caught, who'd been caught as a courier and was about to be executed. And she, like, people were allowed to go see Lincoln personally. Ordinary people could meet him one day a week and make their case for whatever they wanted to make, what they needed. And she begged for the life of her brother. And as Lincoln usually did, especially with younger soldiers, he spared the boy's life. And from then on, even though this woman was a dedicated daughter of the South and a supporter of the Confederacy, she was a huge Lincoln fan because he saved the life of her little brother. And she was on stage that night when Lincoln was assassinated. She actually nodded a greeting to Booth from the stage. He knew her, and he kind of raised his chin a little, and she did a little silent greeting with her eyes that she recognized or saw him. And so that's just one of the little personal stories that you kind of discover when you're doing a project like this. And I never quite realized how much the people who support the Confederacy and the Union interacted, especially in Washington, D.C. And that's what you really learn, is that Booth was this rabid hater of Lincoln and was known as such. But he had friends who, including all of his own family members, who supported the Union, supported the North, and many of the people he worked with did. So people had to learn to live together, even though they were in a war with one another. So we think our political passions are heated. Just kind of imagine what that must have been like when you have relatives on either side of the divide who are being killed in a war, and yet you have to interact with people on the opposite side of your political outlook. I just find that astonishing.
Something like that with porous borders that I had heard was that Custer attended the wedding of a Confederate during the war while he was in his Union uniform. But I always just took that to show another example of how unconventional Custer is. But that's an example that in any war, there are always porous borders when you're dealing with millions of people, like the soccer match in World War I between the two sides.
Right. But I never really kind of thought of that in the American terms. But yeah, it was very much like that. So I think that's kind of important for people today to think about. And that's why this story, I think, is relevant, is we have our political disagreements, but the political disagreements during the Civil War were quite a bit more intense and had a lot more serious consequences.
So that's an example of something mistaken that people would believe about this era or about the assassination. Were there any others that you came across as you were getting into this?
Well, one of the fun things about researching a book like this is you read a lot of books, right? Soon you start seeing the same stories appear, the same anecdotes, because people retell the same things. But what people don't realize with the Lincoln assassination in particular is the story did sort of grow in the telling. Most stories do grow in the telling, but Lincoln's assassination, it grew in the telling as well. And some of these things that were said keep being passed on. And one of the fun things when you do a book like this is you go back and you read the original sources or the eyewitness testimony of the people that were actually on hand at the time. And sometimes there's some divergences between the kind of the conventional accepted views of what actually happened and what the people who were actually there say. And sorting through all that, and that's really basically, you have to read my book to see that, because I do talk about that. But sorting through that, sort of like, what's the American history textbook version of what happened versus what did the eyewitnesses who actually saw it or were involved with it actually say, isn't always the same. And that was fun. So one of the examples I like to use is the whole idea that Lincoln, in almost every book you read that Lincoln had a premonition. He had a dream. Lincoln paid close attention to his dreams, and he talked about them a lot. And so in a lot of books, you'll read that Lincoln had this dream where he woke up and he went downstairs in the White House, and he saw himself lying in state in a casket. And that's why he knew he was going to be killed, was he had this premonition. He had this kind of prophetic dream. The problem is that this story originated about 30 or 40 years after his death by one guy, one U.S. Marshal, who recalled this 30 years later in a book he wrote, that he had been told this by Lincoln. None of Lincoln's family or friends knew anything about this. He didn't tell his wife this story. He didn't tell any of his son. He didn't tell any of his secretaries. No one else remembered this. And most historians today think this was a false memory, that this marshal kind of, he didn't invent it maybe consciously, but, you know, kind of in his own mind, something Lincoln had said grew into that. And so that's why it's nice to go back and kind of look at the original sources and try and sort through things. And that's what this book tries to do, is sort out some of these urban legends that have kind of grown up over time. And it's very interesting, actually.
Right. It's easy to mythologize somebody like Lincoln or Washington if it were a less beloved president like Millard Fillmore. Not that many people are mythologizing him and are willing to take him at face value. Or maybe they're not. I apologize to the Millard Fillmore fans out there in the audience. Yeah. Right. I suppose it's good to set up things like that, the common mythology and the things that people believe. So what are some of the sacred cows or the major myths of the assassination?
Well, what I think people think is that Booth was just a lunatic, or some people think that, you know, this was a Southern conspiracy and so on. And that actually a lot of serious historians and scholars, or some of them at least, think that. But as I said, when you begin researching it, you realize there was a whole backstory to this, and that Booth wasn't crazy. He was kind of a lunatic in one sense, but what he really wanted to do was to kidnap Lincoln and get him down to the South to hold him hostage to release Confederate soldiers that were being held in Union prisons. Towards the end of the war, the South was desperate for soldiers, and General Grant stopped the practice, which had been common up to then, of releasing prisoners of war, because he got tired of being shot at by fellows that they had just let go 2 weeks earlier. So they went right back into the fight. And Grant said, this is crazy. We're letting these people go, and they're going right back in the fight and killing us again. So we're going to end this. So he stopped prisoner exchanges. And so Booth had this sort of crazy idea, but it was just realistic enough that it got enough people involved. Lincoln used to travel about on his own, at least sometimes, occasionally, used to ride his own horse from a soldier's home to his office in Washington during the summer, and he'd be seen with minimal security out and about Washington. And one time he actually had, well, I'll get to that in a second, he had his hat shot off. And so Booth said, you know, the Confederates, or each side has been mounting raids to try and free their prisoners of war from the other side's prisons. It would be a whole lot simpler and might be much more effective if we just kidnap Lincoln on one of his nightly rides and then spirited him off to Richmond, to the South, and held him hostage, demanding the release of all Confederate prisoners. And this sort of crazy plan got the attention of enough Confederate agents and so on in and around Washington that he had a small group, between 25 and as many as perhaps 50 people who were involved in this conspiracy to kidnap Lincoln. And most people don't know that, or at least they don't know very much about it, and how they spent months and months and months trying to set up this kidnapping. And eventually, when the war was lost and the whole war was about to be lost, and the whole purpose of doing that was now moot. Most of the people, the serious people, the people that actually had some something to contribute, dropped out of the conspiracy, dropped out of the plot. So at the end, Booth was left with only two or three ragged, impoverished men who would do whatever he said because he paid them, or they thought he would pay them. And those are the men who were left him at the end. And then it became clear in the last couple of days that that Booth had no intention of kidnapping Lincoln, but realized that he was just going to shoot him. It was easier. And that's actually how it came about. And so I don't think most people know that whole backstory of how it was actually a pretty elaborate plot to try and kidnap Lincoln when he was out riding. And that raises the whole question of what was the security like? I mean, we're used to presidents having helicopter gunships fly over them when they travel in their motorcades and so on. And Lincoln actually did travel about with pretty minimal security by any modern understanding of it. He did have military escorts a lot of the times, but a lot of times he didn't. And it wasn't until about a year before his death that he was riding out again towards Forest Home, and a marksman took a shot at him and shot his famous hat off his head. And there was no more writing about by himself after that. So Booth didn't really know that. He didn't know a lot of stuff. He didn't have a very good intelligence. And from that point on, Lincoln was almost always accompanied with at least a couple of soldiers, a military escort.
Well, that gets us into the interesting world of both Confederate conspiracies and John Wilkes Booth. Let me start with John Wilkes Booth and then talk about Confederate conspiracy theories. I spoke with another author on this podcast, and he mentioned that John Wilkes Booth was the most famous actor of his day. He was the George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Leo DiCaprio, Justin Bieber, whatever your generation is. He was that. Very famous in theater, very much a ladies' man, and he pinned what John Wilkes Booth did on syphilis. He said that the way that he behaved up to the time of the assassination was uncharacteristic compared to his earlier life. So it was almost a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde scenario. So I'm curious in this aspect too. And then that also opens us up to the world of Confederate conspiracies. Were they trying to assassinate or kidnap Lincoln at the very beginning of the war? Do they have other attempts? And when does John Wilkes Booth enter this world? Because for a famous actor to be caught into this plot, it sounds like the movie Zoolander, where a male model is.
Yes.
Which I'm glad you recognize that, because I mentioned that to the other guest and he didn't know the movie. So I was heartbroken.
Well, I have kids, so.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
That's a lot of stuff to go into. First of all, I don't buy the syphilis story. I mean, I could see why somebody might say that, because actually Booth was a little bit madcap his entire life. I mean, his mother was worried about him always. She was scared that something would happen to her beloved child because he was known for his impetuous behavior and for doing dangerous stunts and things like that. He was a reckless guy. And what's amazing about Booth is he was very beloved. It wasn't just that he was the most famous actor in America. That's a bit of a stretch. He was competing. He was like, you know, Brad Pitt, George Clooney, one of those guys. There were a couple of people that were trying to be the most famous actor. He probably made about $500,000 a year in his acting at the time, which was, in our terms, which was a good salary. He was doing very, very well. He was famous, and people loved him. He was considered one of the kindest, nicest people, even after the assassination. His friends continued to sing his praises, and what a great fellow he was when it was very dangerous to do that. I mean, they were talking about the assassin of the president of the United States, and yet they said out loud that he was one of the nicest guys they've ever met. He was kind to children and animals and all that stuff, and they just couldn't believe he would do this. And he was always a person of political passions. He was always an extremist. He always said whatever was on his mind. If I have a theory of what he was, I would say we would call him today maybe bipolar. You know, a lot of actors allegedly are afflicted with bipolar disease. They can be afflicted with a mania, you know, kind of depression and then mania. And that's what was more fit what Booth was like. He was a manic person that would get these crazy ideas and run with them. But he was intensely loyal. He did have friends who were supporters of the Union who took him in stride and so on. So he was a very, very interesting character. And what I love about doing history and stuff and going back is you can read some of his thoughts. I mean, the collective writings of John Wilkes Booth are available. And he was a horrible speller And but he did write down his thoughts. He did write a kind of a political manifesto a couple of years before the assassination, and which became the basis of a manifesto that he had released to an actor friend on the day of the assassination that was never published. It was burned because the guy knew it might implicate him. So he was scared to death when he actually read it after the assassination. So he burned it. He burned this manifesto, just like assassins do today, where they publish their manifestos on Facebook. Booth had this manifesto, an explanation of what he was about to do that he wanted printed in the newspaper. And this fellow agreed to get it to the editors. He didn't know what was in it. And when after the assassination, he read it and was just scared to death. He thought he'd be arrested and implicated as part of the conspiracy and maybe hung. So he burned it. Actually in the Peterson guest house where Lincoln was dying downstairs. And that manifesto was, he claimed to be able to remember later from memory. And it was very similar to a published account of another manifesto that was found in among Booth's effects a couple years after his death, and that was published in the newspapers and only modified slightly. So anyway, he was an extreme fellow from the very beginning, but much beloved. And so I don't think we could simply say it was a result of syphilis or something like that. It was part of his personality that he had growing up and was always like that.
To look at the Confederacy, I think I heard somewhere that there was an earlier assassination plot against Lincoln. Are they always planning this? Do they have Confederate commando teams that are the SEAL Team 6 of the Confederacy thinking, how can we nab Lincoln?
Well, that's another part of the backstory that people don't realize. The Confederacy did look into at least kidnapping Lincoln. And that's why some of the people that advocate, like the historian Edward Steers and so on, advocate that the Confederacy was involved in this, is because there's evidence that they did look into it. There was a Confederate agents went to Washington to case the place, basically, to see if it was feasible. And he concluded that there was no way to do it, that Lincoln had, this is a professional, intelligence officer. And he concluded that Lincoln was too well guarded, that they couldn't pull it off. And see, that's the thing is, John Wilkes Booth was a maniac actor with delusions of grandeur who wanted to do something for the South. He had no military training at all, except for one brief stint in a Virginia militia for 2 weeks, where he, it was more of a lark than anything. He had no training. None of his co-conspirators had really any military or intelligence training at the end. Some of the early conspirators in the kidnapping plot had some, but so this guy really didn't know what he was doing. So when the professional intelligence agents of the Confederacy looked into kidnapping Lincoln, they decided it wasn't feasible. But there was some truth to the fact that things got much nastier towards the end of the war. There were atrocities on both sides. There was something called the Dahl grenade raid. I don't know if you know about that, where the Union was going to attempt to free some prisoners of war being held in Confederate prisons, and there was this raid that was going to go into Richmond, and one of the leaders of the raid, the fellow named Dahlgren, was shot, and when they got his body, they found on it orders that seemed to suggest that they were to go into the Capitol and kill Jefferson Davis, which at the time was considered a violation of the laws of war. I'm not an expert in military law, or the law of warfare, so I can't debate whether it actually was a violation of the laws of war, but it was taken that way. And they took photographs of these documents. The Confederacy, they sent them to newspapers all over the country. It was a big deal. And as a result, guerrilla raids and more, more desperate measures began to be taken on both sides. There were atrocities on both sides. The Confederacy decided to engage in the first act that we know of biological warfare, in that they tried to ship some blankets with smallpox on them into the north and things like that. So once the Dahlgren raid happened, the kind of chivalry aspect of the Civil War was set aside and things got to be much more ruthless in a sense. So that kind of fuels some of the Confederacy conspiracy theories that the Confederacy was involved. I don't think they were, because it was such at the end, it was Keystone Cops time. These guys, John Wilkes Booth and his madcap band of followers, his four or five impoverished fellows who were following him, they would show up to kidnap Lincoln and he wouldn't even be there. Their intelligence was so bad, they clearly didn't know what they were doing. If the Confederacy really was involved, I think it would have been a much more professional operation and it would have been much more successful than it was. So that's my personal belief.
You're right. And it doesn't make sense to choose John Wilkes Booth unless we truly are operating on Zoolander logic, that actors and models can enter exclusive places. But that falls into the dumb conspiracy theories. Like, I've heard that, well, Bruce Lee didn't really die. He went to be an undercover cop with the Hong Kong police. And I thought, yes, you would choose the most famous actor on earth for undercover work. That makes a lot of sense. So.
Yes, yes. Well, that's true. But, you know, I mean, the reason these conspiracy theories have some followers often is because there's a kernel of truth in some of them. There were Confederate agents that were among Booth's earliest team of kidnappers. John Surratt Jr. was a actual courier. There were a couple of other people that were had said, yes, they'll help with the plot to kidnap Lincoln, who were actual honest to God agents of the Confederacy. But it appears that they were just kind of helping out a little bit and they weren't actually acting under orders from Richmond, as they say, as they would say. And that's kind of my take, what I've been able to sort out from reading these firsthand accounts.
Well, I'm curious about this group that does follow John Wilkes Booth, and who are they? What reasons do they have to join him, to be led by someone who has no ability whatsoever to execute something like this? And does the objective change? Because I think you mentioned it changed from kidnapping to assassination. So why did it change and what was this group like?
Well, as I said, there was actually two components to the conspiracy to kidnap Lincoln. At first, Booth was able to convince a few serious, legitimate people to join him, like John Surratt, who was a courier, and a couple other people. So there was a bigger conspiracy to kidnap Lincoln. And they thought it was a crazy plan, but my God, it just might work. And these were desperate times. And if they actually could nab Lincoln on one of his nightly jaunts around Washington, D.C. on his horse, it was plausible, at least in the earliest stages, that they might be able to negotiate some sort of prisoner release or something like that. It was a crazy plan, but they were desperate men at this time. And they thought, you know, it's at least worth exploring. But very quickly, that sort of after so many false attempts and false promises, and when it became increasingly clear that John Wilkes Booth had no idea what he was doing, the serious people dropped out, and he was only left with a handful of, as I said, desperate people who just needed money, and like George Azarot and so on, who was an impoverished German immigrant, at that point, these people just were loyal to him because he was rich and famous, and they would do whatever he said. And he told them that they would get hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, they'd become wealthier beyond their imaginations because he lied, I think. In my opinion, he lied and promised them there'd be this big reward from the Confederacy when the Confederacy wasn't actually actively involved at all. But that's how he kept the handful of people with him until the end, by promising big financial rewards, and because they were desperate, impoverished people who literally didn't know where their next meal was coming from. In the earlier stages, though, there were some more serious Confederate sympathizers who were involved. As for when did Booth decide to kill Lincoln, that is a big question. And some people say that he did not have that intention until as late as April 11th or so, when Lincoln made a speech at the White House late at night about how voting rights for freed African slaves, African American slaves, and supposedly at that point, Booth said that that's it. He was going to do them in, but he hinted at this earlier at a meeting of some of his Confederates at a restaurant a month or two earlier. And they all made it clear they would have no part in murder. And most of them dropped out at that point when they realized that Booth was even thinking about shooting the president. Most of these people had futures and lives, and they didn't want anything to do with assassination. And they just simply said, we're out. If you plan on shooting him, we're out. And that's when he was left with only a few. And he had given hints earlier that was at least on the back of his mind, that if he couldn't pull off the assassination, I mean, if he couldn't pull off the kidnapping, he could always just shoot Lincoln, because he got close enough to Lincoln on a couple of occasions that he knew he could do it. So that is always a big issue. When did he decide? He might have decided, you know, actually made up his mind only a couple of days, you know, where he was going to do it. But I think he had it in the back of his mind for at least a few months before that.
So it sounds like the hangers-on at the end were Pancho Villa's to his Don Quixote.
Yes, very much.
One other thing, too. Were there any details of his story that really stuck out to you of Booth's bumbling incompetence to be able to do something like this, where he's suggesting something that shows he is way out of his depth here?
Well, he was obsessed with the idea of kidnapping Lincoln in Ford's Theater. He had this idea. Ford's Theater, I think, was always his primary or favorite place to do it. I mean, they were considering it the last minute. They didn't know if where Lincoln was actually going to be, if he was going to be at the National Theater or if he was going to be at Ford's Theater. So, you know, Booth was going to improvise, but his preferred place was Ford's Theater. He knew it very, very well. It was known as sympathetic to the Confederacy. The actors there and the people were considered Confederate sympathizers. So that was really what he preferred. And he had this idea, he had this fantasy that during a play, somebody could hit the gas lights and then they could jump Lincoln in the booth, because Lincoln often did go to the theater either by himself or just with one guest. And he had minimal security when he went to the theater, just police bodyguards. And I'll get to that in a second, why there wasn't any police bodyguards guarding Lincoln. And so it wasn't all that crazy that he'd be by himself. But then Booth thought, you know, they could waylay Lincoln, bind him, somehow lift him down onto the stage and then out the back door of the theater and then be carried away in a carriage. But, you know, because he just liked the idea of I think it was the actor in him, the idea of turning off all the lights and then kidnapping the president and the lights come back on and he's gone. And it's just the drama of it without, you know, thinking about that half the people in the audience were soldiers carrying guns. that never quite occurred to him that it might not be very practical. And he asked a couple of different people if they would mind. There was this one actor in New York that he approached. Would you come to the theater and douse the gas lights for me? And this guy said, are you nuts? No way. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And he absolutely refused. And Booth got testy with him and basically kind of threatened him and said, you know, you better keep your mouth shut and I've got a gun. And, you know, he actually threatened the guy. But this was how insane he was, is he had these like fantasies and that was one of them, that they could kidnap Lincoln in the Ford's Theater and turn off the lights and then wheel him out. And then the lights would come back on and the president is gone. It's like a movie script, right? So he thought more like an actor than like an intelligence officer or intelligence agent. So.
Yeah, another Zoolander similarity.
Yes.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. This comes down to the main point that he was bumbling, he was ineffective, he had no idea what he was doing, but he succeeded. And I think that's why he can be so misanalyzed, because many could project onto him this intelligence, because since he was successful, ergo, he must have successfully put together a plan and must have been intelligent enough to do it, but he wasn't. So how on earth did he succeed?
He succeeded because it was kind of a perfect combination of things happened that smoothed his way. First of all, Lincoln did have absolutely minimal security by modern standards. When he went to the theater, he was supposed to have police bodyguards. The police bodyguard assigned for that night was a guy named John Parker. He was a notorious drunk, and he left his station. He was supposed to be guarding the president. But once Lincoln was safely in the presidential box, he went to watch the play, and then he disappeared into the saloon, as did many of the people watching the play, and actually a lot of the actors as well. They would go to the saloon at every intermission. And John Parker disappeared into the night and didn't know Lincoln was assassinated until he showed up in the Metro Washington police station at midnight with a prostitute that he had under arrest. And he didn't even realize that the person he was supposed to be guarding had been shot. And inexplicably, this guy remained a presidential bodyguard for a couple more years until finally he was caught drunk on duty one too many times and was dismissed. So the security around Lincoln was extremely lax by our standards. During the day, when he went about, he was accompanied by a military escort, and they were capable, but he would go out to things like the theater with only a single bodyguard. And this one particular bodyguard just wasn't there. Also, Booth knew Ford's Theater like the back of his hand. He had acted on the stage. He had sat in the presidential booth box himself and watched plays. He was friends with everybody there. Everybody knew him. He was trusted. He could go anywhere he wanted. He had the run of the place. So he was able to succeed because of that combination of factors that everybody let him go wherever he wanted. He was that night, in fact, two other messengers had come to the presidential box right before and had been allowed in. Lincoln had a kind of a valet or an assistant who was guarding the door, sitting outside the door. He wasn't a bodyguard. He was just kind of his helper. And he was standing outside, and he let two other people come, including one reporter who had a message for the president. They let him in. They came out. Nothing happened. So when Booth showed up, this fellow did challenge Booth and say, this presidential boxer, you're not allowed in. Booth produces a card, perhaps the card of his alleged fiance's father, who was a senator, Senator Hale, and said, I have news for the president. And because he had this pretext, the guy, having let two other people in just 15 minutes before, said, fine, you can go in and see him. So that combination of kind of factors made it possible for this fellow, who actually didn't know what he was doing, really, to successfully assassinate the president of the United States.
Hmm. But then, it's a perfect storm. But after that, there's the largest manhunt in U.S. history at that point. But he's able to evade capture for 2 weeks, and he can't even walk well at that point. So after blundering into success this time, he does pretty well on the run when he can't run. How does he do it?
That's right. He absolutely did. And again, he had the luck of the devil for a while. He happened upon a serious Confederate agent who actually knew what he was doing. And this fellow, out of just loyalty to the cause, he refused to take any money aside from the boat, the amount of money, I think it was $20 or $18. The only money he would accept from Booth at the end of all this was the amount for the boat that Booth was going to take off in. He refused any financial gain. He did it entirely out of loyalty to the South, to hide Booth. And he basically said, look, you have no way of getting out of here. This is the largest manhunt in history. There's no way you can flee and get away. And he recommended that Booth simply hide in plain sight and literally lie down in a wet pine thicket. And when the soldiers were going house to house, every farmhouse, and looking for these for Booth and his co-conspirator, he said, no, just lie in this thicket, and I'll bring you food every day, and then eventually they'll move on. And that's exactly what happened. So Booth was cold and miserable, lying in this outdoors, without a fire, in this wooded thicket of trees, while Confederate soldiers raced down roads searching for him and went to every farmhouse in the area. he would have been caught if he hadn't followed this guy's advice and just hid in plain sight for 2 weeks with his leg. And he couldn't walk by that point. He had his broken leg set, but it wasn't set very well, and he didn't have crutches or anything. He could barely walk. So he just went to ground and waited until the Union soldiers finally decided. They finally eventually got a report that was false, that he had been seen in Virginia, and so they left Maryland, and that's when he tried to get away by taking a boat across the Potomac. But that's the only reason he was able to stay at large for 2 weeks, because this guy hit him outdoors in a pine thicket.
And then he's caught when he's going across on the boat.
He wasn't caught on the boat. It took a couple of days before he could get caught. Again, they didn't know what they were doing. This guy gave him a boat, told him where to go. He had to cross the river and to a particular landing spot, and that they would find Confederate sympathizers there, which they did. It took them two nights to do that. The first time they ended up going up in the wrong direction. It was hard for them to figure out. The Potomac is a mighty river, and crossing the Potomac where they were was not a small undertaking, especially when there were Union gunboats patrolling, looking for them. So it was a big deal, but they finally made it on their second attempt. And then again, it was sheer luck. Because of that false report that they had been seen, a couple of detectives in Washington decided to get a posse up and head to this location where Booth had not actually been seen, but people looking like him had been seen. And by sheer luck, they actually ended up right on his trail and ended up tracking him down where he was hiding out in a barn of a family that took him in. And that's where he eventually was caught, was at this, in this tobacco barn on the Garrett farm. And they tracked him down in a couple of days. These detectives finally tracked him down, even though the only reason they went on the initial scent was because of a false report. So that was sheer luck too. It was sheer luck that he was caught once he got away. It's an interesting story.
Yeah, he just bumbles from one mishap to mishap. He's an interesting figure. And before we wrap this up and think about what are the larger scale implications of your research, something else that you mention is that if we shift focus to Abraham Lincoln himself, that his final day on earth was one of the happiest of his life. And he famously struggled with depression, what they called melancholy back then. So how did you glean that from his writings, and why was he happy his final day?
Everybody said so. The eyewitness reports. Lincoln was very depressive, just given the nature of his job. The country was at war. But what he had set out to do, which was to hold the Union together, to hold the country together, he succeeded in doing. And that day, they knew that for sure. That the day that he died, they knew that the war was won and that the Union was going to be held together. And for the first time in a long time, Lincoln started thinking about his own future, about his life after the presidency. He was ebullient. He combed his hair. Everybody talked about how good he looked. He was smiling. He was talking about how the war was over. He went out on a carriage ride with his wife, Mary Lincoln, and they talked about maybe making a trip to California, where so much was happening, and that he was going to open a law office. Maybe they could even make a trip to Palestine and he could see Jerusalem. They were making plans. The war was ending at last. Lincoln had plans for broad amnesty for the South. He told all the soldiers if they would just lay down their arms, they could go back to their families in time. They could keep their horses for springtime planting. Grant told the Confederate officers they could keep their guns. Just promise not to shoot anymore, and you could just go home. So Lincoln was in an absolutely fantastic mood. And everybody who met him commented, "You look so much different, Mr. President. You look downright cheerful." And it really was the happiest day he'd had in many years. And I can honestly say Abraham Lincoln died a happy man. He didn't know what was about to hit him. And he was having the time of his life at Ford's Theater, enjoying just the sort of lowbrow comedies that he liked. My American Cousin was about a kind of a corn-fed Yankee who goes to England, and with his Yankee honesty and homespun common sense, sets everything to right. And Lincoln was laughing his head off during this play, and it kind of flattered him because that's what people thought of him. And the audience was in great spirits, and the draft had just been suspended, and everybody was in just a great mood, and they gave him a standing ovation. So he did indeed die a happy man.
So in looking at this story, what do you think is the big takeaway of trying to reassess Lincoln's assassination that you hope can correct some of the common tropes you see in narratives and history books all over the place?
Well, I hope people read my book. There's dozens of, why read another book on Lincoln? You know, people always ask me that. My answer is people should read this book precisely because there are so many Lincoln books out there. I've read most of them. And the problem is that many of the books have too much detail. They get bogged down in long scholarly disputes. And the worst part of it is they advocate a particular viewpoint that isn't actually proven. For example, that Lincoln was assassinated as part of a Confederate plot. That is one point of view that actually hasn't been proven, and I think is actually not the case. So it's just so much a part of American history. The political passions that drove Booth to kill Abraham Lincoln are still operative today. They grow out of the conflict between Republicans and Democrats that are still raging today. The political polarization that we experience today began in a sense in this era. So it's also a cautionary tale about letting politics kind of edge out common sense. And so I think people really should think about the Lincoln assassination more than we actually do. And because all the characters are so interesting, Abraham Lincoln's very interesting. John Wilkes Booth in his own crazy way is very interesting. His family doing their best to protect their crazy brother. All of that is something people can relate to. So that's why I think this is a great story.
Absolutely. And I love these types of counterintuitive facts or a reexamination of something that we think we know well. So the book is What Really Happened? The Lincoln Assassination. Very succinct right there. So Bob, really appreciate this. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, the McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.